How much money do you lose every time you miss a customer call? With a Buzz CRM, you never have to worry about that again. Their system automatically texts missed calls and engages leads instantly using conversational AI. It turns your missed opportunities into booked appointments automatically. It's a complete game changer for local businesses. Secure your access today for a massive discount at thebuzzcrm.com. That's thebuzzcrm.com.
Welcome back, my friends. I am Vivian McPeak, and this is Hemp Present. If you have feedback or would like to suggest a guest or topic for Hemp Present, please email me at hemppresent@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. Lynette Shaw is a trailblazing medical marijuana activist, best known as the first legally licensed cannabis dispensary operator in the United States, as the founder of the Marin Alliance Medical Marijuana in Fairfax, California. She became a central figure in the fight for patients' rights after the passage of Proposition 215 in 1996. But for decades, Shaw battled DEA raids, federal injunctions, and financial ruin, refusing to back down even when the government tried to brand her a criminal. Lynette's work laid the foundation for today's medical and recreational cannabis industries, though she remains outspoken about the movement's roots in compassion, human rights, and grassroots activism, rather than corporate profit. But don't take my word for it. She's right here with me. Welcome, Lynette, to Cannabis Radio.
Thank you, Viv. That's quite an introduction, but it's all
well,
true.
it's what happened. You know, yeah. Lynette, we go so far back. You know, I have so much love and admiration for you. You're often called the godmother of medical marijuana dispensaries. You started working for the late Bay Area California medical cannabis icon, Dennis Perone, in 1991. Can you take us back to the early days? What drove you to open one of the very first cannabis collectives in California? What was that experience like?
Well, I got to tell you, I got busted for pot, and I was waiting to go to jail. And my friend said, hey, there's this guy named Jack Harrah that's going to talk about hemp up there in Occidental. And I said, what's hemp? Okay, that was 1990. So I went and saw Jack, and it just completely changed my life. He was the most articulate, fascinating, informative, funny, incredible public speaker. And I got the book, and I told him I was going to go to jail for pot, and he signed it for me. And I read that book overnight. I couldn't put it down. And then I read it again the next day. And then I called and drove all the way to Van Nuys to work for Jack. And then Jack sent me up to San Francisco to help Pebbles. And that's how I met Dennis Perone, was through Pebbles Triffitt, because I was in the Castro helping gather signatures for the first medical marijuana initiative, Proposition P, in San Francisco that Dennis had put together. So that's how I met Dennis Perone. And then we were successful with that, making it the lowest possible priority, taking away the budget. That was the trick. That was Dennis's insight. You take away the budget, they don't get a raid. And it worked. And then I walked into the club. There was a gathering at the Hall of Flowers in San Francisco. That's where I met everybody, 50 people in the movement, many whom I work with to this day, with Dale Geringer, Alan Comp, Lynn and Judy Osborne, all these people. And Dennis took me to the club that day. That was in April of 1991. And I walked into the Church Street Club, and it was the most heartbreaking and most inspiring thing I think I ever walked up into. I walked up these stairs, and I went past the little guard, because I had Dennis with me, you know. And we walked into this room, beautiful room, Persian rugs on the floor, hanging plants, you know, comfortable couches. There was a bunch of people that were very thin and very, you know, sunken. But they were laughing, and they were smoking some pot, and they were enjoying each other's companies, and they were all deathly ill with AIDS. And so I said, Dennis, what can I do to help you? My God, you know, I can tell what's going on, but look at them. They're relaxed, and they're happy, and they're having the food and stuff. And he goes, well, you're a nice girl, kind of quiet, and I need some help there doing intake counseling. I said, okay, Dennis. And that's how I started working at the first cannabis club in all history in the Castro, in the midst of the AIDS epidemic and the drug war. So it was exciting times, to say the least.
I too met Jack Herer in 1990. Uh-huh. And I had pretty much the exact same experience of getting a copy of The Emperor Wears No Clothes. And as you know, Jack was, you know, spoke at the first Seattle Hemp Fest, and he only missed 1 year in the next decades. And that's the year that he had his initial stroke. He refused to stop. I mean, here's a guy learning to speak again. And anybody else in the world would have, like, I'm done doing speaking at public events. Not Jack, man. Mm-hmm. He just kept going. I've never seen anything like it.
He was amazing.
He was one of the most driven, committed people I've ever seen. In April 1991, you just spoke that you went to the Hall of Flowers in Golden Gate Park for the first marijuana convention. Did you have a sense back then that you were living and witnessing cannabis culture history? I mean, could you just briefly describe the event?
It was stunning. It was, I mean, there was 50, 60 people in this room believed, as I believed, that it was a terrible crime against humanity to have marijuana be to throw us all in jail. And I was going to jail, you know. And it was finding people from the same planet, the camaraderie, the support, the lawyers that were there trying to fight. That's why I met Tony Serra. It was astonishing, you know. I knew it was very important. I could feel how important that the start was. This was really, really the birth of a revolution. It was there. You can feel it in the vibes, you know, and the people I met. And I was helping doing videography that day because I was deep into doing television production of local, you know, PBS type things. And I ended up filming. I was the camera, lead camera for filming stuff for Time for Hemp. And we filmed all these people, Gatewood Galbraith, a bunch of people that are no longer with us, and just articulate and passionate and inspiring. And, you know, it really pivoted me into the first wave of the movement. It was impossible for me to ignore or not do anything, you know.
Right. Yeah. Gatewood was, you know, another iconic figure. He did so much, you know, Kentucky politician and cannabis and hemp activist. Can you talk about the time that Dennis Perrone beckoned you to come to San Francisco because he was tipped off by City Hall that he was going to be busted the following day?
Oh my God. I was working 7 days a week for Dennis at that point. And I was the secretary and doing a lot of work. He trained me to be a lobbyist and a spokeswoman for like CNN and stuff, you know. And he called us all and he said, "You got to come to my house tonight because we're going to get raided tomorrow. And we have to talk about what we're going to do because we need to get a jury of our peers to acquit us for doing the right thing." Okay, Dennis. So I took the bus to San Francisco and got off the bus around the corner, you know, and going to work. I went to Dennis's house that night, but after he called us, I got on the bus and got to San Francisco and went to Dennis's, and we had all the staff was there around his kitchen table. And he said, "Well, I got a call from City Hall, and they're going to come and raid us tomorrow. And this is what I told you might or probably would happen. And we need a jury of our peers to weigh in about medical marijuana and the AIDS crisis." And we're all going, "Oh, Dennis, we don't want to go to jail. We don't want to get busted. Why don't we just close the club and let them cool off? Oh, Dennis." And Dennis stops us all, pounds his fist on the table, you know, and says, "Are you men or are you mice? Oh, Dennis, we're going to go to jail tomorrow."
So Dennis was tipped off by City Hall because he was friends with the mayor, Harvey Milk, right?
Yeah, he was best friends with Harvey Milk. And he had lots of connections at City Hall. And when Harvey was assassinated, he was the spokesperson for the Castro. He was a primary proponent for gay rights when we did that initiative in California. And also, he was a former Marines staff supply sergeant. So in Vietnam, so he was tough and he was organized.
I never knew that about Dennis.
Yeah. Wow. That's how he could make those battle plans. And plus, being a supply sergeant, he was so organized. He knew what was going on. He would do his homework. He knew he had all these notes. He had John Edwards. And we were taking notes and we were, figuring out this big battle plan. So complicated, but everything was right on. He introduced us to, he took us up to Sacramento to lobby. And I was like the cute chick, and I put in my professional power suit with the high heels, and poofy hair and stuff and nails. Hi, I'm here to talk to you about medical marijuana, and I brought some patients with me, and I march in what Dennis called the unfortunate dog and pony show of crippled people, parts of people, made them cry. That was my mission, make the senator cry. And that's how we got votes, tier by tier, door by door. That's how we got the votes in the California legislature.
Wow.
And that was all Dennis's doing. He was amazing. And then, so here's what happened on, it was April 14th, 1994. I came in on the bus, because I didn't want to park in that area. So I came in from Marin on the bus, and the bus stop was around the corner from the pot club. And I got off the bus, and there was about half a dozen of our patients there. I said, what's going on? He goes, we're here to escort you. I said, really? Okay. So we went around the corner, and to my utter astonishment, the building was surrounded by hundreds of people, patients, with their wheelchairs and their canes and their walkers, and they were all as big as your little finger, and they locked their little arms together to protect us, to make them go through them before they got to me. So it's still me.
You're breaking up a little bit.
This is actually assembly of people.
Lynette,
and
Lynette,
they all start cheering.
Lynette, we lost you for a second, so you could just back up about a sentence.
Okay. So going around the corner, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. Walking around the corner where I could see the club on Church Street, I could see the building, and it was surrounded by hundreds of people, our patients. And they saw me coming down, and they all started to cheer because I was their girl, I was the staff, and I was going to go in and fight for them. And do what we could to save them all, So we escorted us upstairs through all these people, giving us the high five. And there was three people deep upstairs in the club, and we had candles burning, and we were, and this whole, the staff was there with Dennis, and we were like holding hands and just praying. What could you do? Meditating, try to stay calm because they're coming. And more people were gathering in the streets, and we had a city block, and it was surrounding a city block with people. And then the local police pull up, and everybody starts booing, boo, go away. These are our people. You can't take away our medicine. Don't take away our people. Right. So they were only there for a few minutes and they pull away. Yay. Okay. And then about 20 minutes later, in comes the sheriff. The sheriff's got a paddy wagon, and everybody downstairs, and we're looking out the window downstairs, and we're all shaking, and we all know that, and they're shaking their fists, and they're yelling at the sheriff's paddy wagon, the sheriffs that were in there, leave us alone, leave our people alone, go away, we need our medicine, don't take our medicine, right? And so they were there for about 5 minutes. And Dennis was on the phone calling the media. He had all the press contacts, right? And he started calling the media as soon as the local police showed up. And so then all of a sudden, the media came. We had Channel 2, we had Channel 3, 4, 5, 7, PBS, CNN. radio guys were there, the newspaper guys were there. They got there, I don't know, in a flash, right? Then the big black paddy wagon pulls up, and it's the DEA. It's the feds. And they got enough to take everybody then some, right? And they and the chant started, DEA, go away. DEA. And we're just crying, and we're looking out the window, scared to death, but holding strong because we need this case. We were going to go and win this case for everybody. And they chant and they chant and they chant and they shake their fist, and more people, they start to surround this big black paddy wagon full of feds and SWAT team. You can see the driver was in SWAT gear, right? And the media was there, and they were there, it seemed like forever and ever, but it was about 20 minutes. They held their own. And then all of a sudden they started honking their horn and flashing their lights and honking their horn and flashing their lights. And they inched away from the pot club and all the crowds in the street. It was just everywhere. And left. And everybody was cheering. I'm sure you could hear the cheering around all the way around San Francisco. Everybody was screaming and cheering and crying, you know. And we're freaking out upstairs. And so we're waiting. What's going to happen? Are they going to come back? Are they going to come back with a whole bunch more people? What's going to happen, right? We wait and we wait and we wait. About an hour later, Dennis gets the phone call from City Hall. Dennis, you did it. They're not coming back. You're safe, right? Wow. And so we're just besides ourselves, right? Somehow we've been spared. It could have been a brutal beating, you know, and jail and you know, all this stuff. So Dennis says, wait, everybody wait. We're going to wait because something could happen. We have to wait. So we waited. We waited 90 minutes, and he made a phone call. And all of a sudden, the guys with the big duffel bags full of pot came bouncing up the steps because there wasn't a single gram in that pot club for them to take. You know, we could take us, but they couldn't take our medicine. So that's when we started throwing joints out the window. And we started giving away pot to everybody who'd come to save us. We were throwing eights out the window, joints out the window. We were just giving it away for the rest of the afternoon. You know, wow. and that's when I knew that we were going to win for sure, because they can't stand up to the power of the people.
That is, that's a quite a story, Lynette, I have to tell you. And that's the kind of moxie, that's the kind of courage and moxie and, you know, determination that we need right now in the country and the world. You guys, you know, you got away with it that time, but you personally went up against the federal government. Tell us a little about that and the toll that took on your life and what kept you from giving up.
Well, we were so crowded at Church Street that Dennis decided to find another building and move the pot club. And this, we're still in the, you know, we're not legal, but we obviously have won points, you know. So he went down the street on Market Street and found some old crappy 5-story building and rented it. You know, it was dirty. It was full of stuff. It was, oh, God, it was awful. And then he sent in everybody, the crew, you know, and they cleaned it all up and they painted it all up. And we had this giant 5-story building for the pot club. Now, the upstairs was the like the war room. You know, we had the map on the wall and then a couple of desks and computers, and, you know, paper and printout and faxing, all that stuff, right? And then the next floor down, the fourth floor, was like it was a entertainment room. We built a stage, you know, making sort of a place to have music and stuff. And then the next three floors, there was the entry floor on the bottom, and you had to get through the guards, and we had two floors of marijuana. You know, this is in 1996, you know, 1995, excuse me. Two floors full of marijuana of all different kinds. You know, indoor, this is the indoor floor, that's the outdoor floor, you know. And it was extraordinary. So I was doing a lot of delivery to Marin County, where I live, because we had an AIDS crisis there also. Small county, but the per capita rate was second in the nation, being San Francisco being the first, of course. We had a crisis in my home area. So I was going crazy delivering all over Marin County. So Dennis says, well, maybe, I got a lot of help here in San Francisco, and maybe you should open a club in Marin, and I'll help you. Okay, Dennis. So I searched around and found this old medical building in Fairfax, which is where I was living. And I just went downtown and talked to the manager, and I said, he knew who I was. You know, the gossip spreads fast. He says, you should open it here. You know, I'll support you. The landlord will support you. I said, really? Okay. The landlord, Farshid Izazi, had an uncle who had cancer that used medical marijuana. So he knew the truth. So so I moved in, and it was like a campaign headquarters and underground pot club. That's how we founded it in Fairfax at the place at School Street Plaza. And we coordinated 35,000 signatures out of Marin County, which was 10% of everybody there, and for their 215 campaign. That was pretty, we had a lot of support. And when we did the vote, Marin County came in from 78% to 94% yes. 94% was Bolinas, California, or one guy voted against it or something, I don't know. So that's how I got the pot club. Then it was in all the news, because I was a media liaison for Dennis Perone, all the news media covered me, even though we were not legal. We had this campaign headquarters. And then we won. And so the news media had been following me, but they were afraid to bust me. They didn't know what to do, so they left us alone. And then the police chief, who had gotten a lot of grief about busting an AIDS patient with three plants or something, which he felt guilty about, he contacted me and said, we need to meet, I'll buy you coffee. I said, yes, sir. Yeah, never had coffee with a cop before. And the chief said, look, I got to tell you something that I can't tell anybody else. I said, really? Over coffee, there's nobody there. They said, there are police officers who have we didn't know that when you're in the field, you better wear rubber gloves. And they can't talk about it. And I said, wow. And he says, do those brownies really help the AIDS patients? The chief of police of the town of Fairfax was asking me for medical advice about pot. And I saw that he had a heart of gold, you know, and I told him the truth. I said, this is tremendously helpful. He says, well, hypothetically, if you were in my position, what would you do? And I handed him my folder. I brought some, you know, information about medical marijuana and what brownies do and what pot does for sick people. I said, here, maybe you should read this. And if I were you, hypothetically, maybe I would turn my head. Okay. Well, he got a hold of me 30 days later and said, well, the sickest one gained 30 pounds in a month on brownies. So we saved an officer. That officer actually only survived for another 2 years, but he survived for two more years. And, you know, and
you cut out again, Lynette.
Really? Hello?
Now you're back. Hey, so I've got just a couple more questions I want to make sure we squeeze in here. We've got, what okay. do we have? 7 minutes.
Okay.
But tell us about your experience with the federal government.
Okay, sorry. Well, the chief pushed through this this license. It was the first actually in the world to actually legally have a license to legally sell pot. And it was in all the papers, CNN, and I was in Time magazine, and the Washington Post front page. And I got, in 1998, I was sued by President Clinton by some guy in a SWAT gear and handed me some papers, and I had to go to court. And they had gotten all the pot illegal, six of us who had pot clubs, and brought us into court. Three of them folded right away, and myself, Ukiah, and Oakland decided to fight. because I had a license. I had the only license, and they, and under state law. So they, we had to go to court three times a week. And then, and they, it was very slow moving, of course. And some of the lawyers dropped out, and we're, and then I ended up being by myself with my one lawyer. And we fought and fought and fought and fought for 16 years straight. I was harassed by agents. They were outside my house. They were outside my place of business. They were cruising around with their DEA special agent cars. They made bumper stickers that said U.S. out of Fairfax over me. And then we went to court, and we finally, but they couldn't get me closed because of all the laws and constitution and all that. So they seized the landlord's land in order to shut me down after 16 years of litigation. So, oh boy. So we had to move because they seized the landlord's land. And that's when we closed. And I was closed for 5 years. And then they changed the law about, they removed the budget for medical marijuana at the congressional level. So I called my lawyer and I said, doesn't this mean that my injunction is moot? And he said, well, yeah. Well, let's go to court and get it thrown out. It's a long shot, Lynette. Okay. So we went back to court, and they were surprised we'd see us back in court, but they were listening to our arguments. And then we were in court with those Charles Breyer, Honorable Charles Breyer. And they sent in, they had the guys from D.C. and a woman from D.C., and she came up. And our argument was, well, there's now thousands of pot clubs that are licensed across the nation. They call it dispensaries in court. Why can't my client go back to work? There's no budget. They can't raid. So they come up and they say, well, we don't care what anyone else has. She just can't have a dispensary in open court in front of Judge Breyer. Judge Breyer was furious. He stood up and excoriated the prosecution for violating the Constitution. Chewed them out for a long time. And then he said, okay, I will let you know about my decision fairly soon. So his decision was extremely in our favor. And in fact, he had language that stopped the DEA from ever bothering me ever again, as long as I was following state law. That protective order extends to everybody with a state license. They can't come. And that's when the raids stopped in California in 2016, they quit. The decision came in at the end of 2015. 2016, the raids stopped. We had to go to court for the landlord. And that was right when Trump came in, and Trump had fired the whole DOJ. He fired my prosecutor, and they let us go because the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and Obama hated me. So he let the landlords go, and I was to go back to work and protect all the landlords too. And that's when we opened up 2017.
Real quickly, because I want to give you an opportunity to give some URLs. We've got a little over 2 minutes. Medical marijuana was legalized in 1997, the adult use of cannabis in California in 2016. How do you feel about the way the cannabis industry has evolved, especially like with large corporations that are in the market compared to the grassroots patient-focused movement that you build? Do you think the current legalization model has betrayed the grassroots activists and patients who build it in any way?
Absolutely. It was, the regulations in California are unfair, unworkable, and nobody's making any money, even the big corporations. They can't, it's overtaxed, overregulated, the fees are enormous, and the regulation is just onerous, and it needs to be totally redone by people who know something about the industry. But
right.
It's very discouraging to everybody. And right now, my club is closed because my beloved Rent Alliance, they sold the land out from under us, and we had to move. And then we have another building, but it's hung up in some legal stuff, so I've got to wait. And now, for the first time in years, I don't have my dispensary. And I have more free time, and I'm able to assess what the industry is doing. I've been talking to a lot of people since I have time to talk to people in the industry instead of working. And everybody's miserable, you know, and it's wrong. Yeah.
Lynette, we have a minute left. So very quickly, what last information, URLs, contact information, or whatever would you like to leave us with in like a minute or under?
Yeah, definitely. How to contact me is CBC, Marin Alliance. CBC, Cannabis Buyers Club, Marin, M-A-R-I-N, Alliance, A-L-L-I-A-N-C-E, at gmail.com. That's the best way to get a hold of me. And you can send me emails, and I will definitely respond.
Marin, as in Marin County, California?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And is there a URL that you want to share, or is that email?
Right now it's down. Yep. The club is down, okay. So my website is down.
Okay.
And the best way to contact me is the email. And,
got it.
Yeah, and I should be back to work by sometime next year.
Lynette, but, Shaw, yeah. you're amazing. Mass love and respect, my sister. Thank you for all your work, and thank you for being on the show and sharing your incredible journey with us.
It's my honor and a privilege to be working with you. As always, I love you, Viv, and we'll talk later.
I love you too. All right. The Hemp Present intro music is 7 Mile Beach by Joanne Rand, and the outro music's Take Back the Plant by those crazy guys, Sticker Bush. See you next time, folks. Stay strong.
Man!